Andy, bud, hey, just calling to say thank you so much for dinner the other night. That was really fun. I'm so stoked to see you always. And I always feel like I overshare, when we catch up and stuff, because it's just so easy to talk to you, and I feel so vulnerable with you, and it's wonderful. But I know you do your podcast and stuff, and I was just like wondering, please don't put the stuff that I talk to you about out on display, I mean, look, when you fuck someone and they want you to pee in their mouth, you're gonna do it. So yeah, I did it, but you don't have to tell anyone. That should just stay between us, because we're friends. So, yeah, you fuck someone, you pee in their mouth. Okay. Like, who has to pee in someone's mouth? You know what I'm saying? But love you, and it was really good to see you. And just don't share with anyone. Okay, bye.
Hey guys, it's Andy. How you doing? How's everyone doing out there? Guess what? We just put out another new single off our new record that we're not announcing yet, but you're starting to get the hint of it. It's called Spill the Beans. It's a great, I love this tune. I wrote this tune in Nashville with Vince Herman and Paul McDonald and Aaron Ratliff, and it was like part of the Nashville sessions, and I was going through, an existential moment about being honest with myself, and this song came out, and I think you're going to really dig it. It's about just understanding who you are, your flaws, and your addictions, and just be okay with them. And if they're fucking your head up, then we need to fix it. But we just have to start being honest, and that's the first communication about trying to get our heads right. So ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy. Play the flutes, Chris. Please enjoy it. A world premiere of our new single, Spill the Beans.
I love mushrooms, I love coke, off to Pluto, man, let's go, wherever you're going, I'm going with you. I'm a weirdo, little crazy, can't remember no name, so it's Buddy or Baby. Why do I keep on hiding? Why do I keep on? Let's get real. It's about time to admit how we feel. I know you know what I mean. Spill the beans. I love reefer, couple pills. I don't mind if we coast or go climb hills.
Great job.
I bet you were so fucking hot when you were 25.
And we're back. Andy Frasco's World Saving Podcast. We're just admiring Floyd's jawline. Floyd, you have a great jawline.
Wow, 30 seconds we made it before we're talking about Floyd's in the
podcast. I know. He showered. Everyone clap it up. He showered today for Boston. Let's go. Yeah. Let's go, Floyd.
Hell yeah.
Let's go. Come here. Come here.
Let's get him out of the way.
How are we doing, everyone? How's our heads? How's our hearts?
There we go.
I got to say that for my mom because she misses me saying that. I love you, Mom. She's like, why don't you say that more? I'm like, okay.
She wanted to fire me because of it, but whatever.
Floyd, come here. Everyone, give it up for Floyd Kellogg. Here he is.
Hi, people.
Top of the show.
Really interesting content, Floyd.
Hi, everyone.
You're already drinking a Guinness? It's just sound check.
It's like a meal.
We had a noon sound check too, guys. It was early.
Yeah, it's a thick soup. I don't know how you drink Guinness. You like it?
Yeah.
You're just doing it because it's... Well, let me try it.
Do you like Guinness?
No.
This is slowly turning into a halftime.
Oh, God. This is so gross. Really? I think so. Floyd, we were drinking till 5 a.m. last night, and you're just back at it.
Hair of the dog, brother.
We were.
We're in Massachusetts. This is where you're from.
Oh yeah.
You lived here. How are you expecting this show to turn out?
Is your bride coming?
Is it weird? I don't really care.
All right, you're done. Bye.
Get out of here.
Later, Floyd. Thanks for coming to the show.
Okay, that'll be the end. Start it over.
The shows have been lit.
Lit as fuck this weekend.
Oh my God. DC. New York was insane. DC was fucking fun.
But Philly.
Philly.
Philly show the tour for
Shout
me.
Shout out to fucking
Number
Philly.
Number one. I'm ranking them in my mind. I'm going to do an awards.
Philly and Buffalo were the rowdiest.
I think Dallas was pretty killing.
Oh, yeah. I think forgetting that was part of this tour,
but
too.
See, I have a better memory than you. So I'm going to do a little awards show at the end of the podcast. I'll do best green room, most lit crowd,
We were thinking of Schwartz and I were thinking about making an award ceremony for everyone who didn't get a Grammy.
So what, 97% of the musicians out there?
Yeah.
I'd rather have that this year. Than a Grammy. Grammys make no sense. It's like
it does.
Best new artist is like some guy's 35. It's like had 8 albums out.
Speaking of Grammys, we have Grammy nominated Bela Fleck on the show.
Yeah,
13 Grammys.
Yeah, but it's different when Bela Fleck wins it.
Yeah? Why?
Yeah, because he's not famous, so it's like more legit, right?
Yeah, he's
more
like of an more, art, it's more like of an he's art like award. Musician.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty lit.
Also,
yeah, I'm excited.
I bet if you asked him his top 10 favorite things about his career, Grammy wouldn't even come up.
I asked him that. I'm like, no one's fucking with you. You got 13. He's like, I don't care about it.
Exactly. He didn't care.
He's like, it's just, I just want to make music. Yeah. Oh, fuck. Well, we were going to talk about, we were going to give ratings for hot jam guys because we've been.
Well, with the jam band gossip is we have a new king of the hot guy of the jam band.
Who is it?
I actually don't know his first name. I just know it's Gator.
Gator is hot from Pigeons.
I think he might be the hottest guy in the jam band scene now. Can I make my case?
All right, go ahead.
Obviously, it used to be Ryan Stasek. Ryan, you might want to turn this podcast off right here. Skip ahead 15 minutes because that's how long I'm going to go. I'm just kidding. First of all, Gator, young, extremely attractive, drummer. So he's going to stay in shape forever.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say what kind of car he has because I don't want to embarrass him, but it's nice. Okay?
It's a nice whip.
It's a whip and a half.
Dude,
okay?
He's a bachelor. He's living his best life.
And that's
life.
The point I'm getting at. I don't know if you can be the hottest guy if you're a dad anymore. I just think.
What? Why?
I mean, he's still top
Floyd's
five.
Floyd's hot. He's a dad.
But he's not the hottest.
He's up there.
There has to be like the chance that it could happen, I think.
Oh, with Floyd?
These guys are faithful men that don't cheat on their wives. You're so that, right. Like these women or men, whoever's attracted to him. There has to be some sort of, it could happen, and I don't, it's not them. They're.
What about Matt from Talk?
We were talking about him, too. I think he's in the top five, too.
Yeah, he's a hot guy.
Good-looking dude.
Yeah.
Tall. Good at guitar.
Who else?
Nice guy.
Isaac's hot from Talk. That's
Isaac,
a hot band.
Yeah, they're a good-looking band, aren't they? Yeah. Damn. Actually, they're all good-looking.
Yeah, Charlie Dolan's hot, too.
They're all good-looking dudes.
He's like a dad.
Yeah, he's a hot dad.
Yeah.
But also, again, there's the thing where it's. Can't have it, but maybe the thing where you can't have it makes them hotter too. I just don't think it does. In my opinion,
do you think Mark Brownstein was ever hot?
Yeah,
yeah.
He's hot now.
He's hot.
He just carries himself in a very hot way.
He's all about crypto. I was giving him shit about him promoting crypto more than his band these days, and he's like, "Fuck you, Frasco."
Well, crypto's on the way up.
I know. He's always on the way up. Oh, I just got that
joke. It's a joke, Brownie.
Fucking stupid. No, you can't make fun of Brownie like that.
Brownie would laugh at that joke.
None of those guys listen to this
podcast.
I didn't
say they're on the down. They're just, you know. Crypto's different, though. It's on the way up compared to everything. I would listen to Brownie on financial advice.
I told him, we're about to go to Mexico tomorrow, and that's where we're recording this in Boston, so we haven't played the show yet. We're in the green room. We're about to go to Mexico, go hang out with all the dads.
Of all the jam bands, guys, I would definitely listen to Brownie about financial stuff. I'm not kidding.
I got matching Speedos for me and Stasic.
What do they look like? What Lakers players on them?
No, it's just like a bright green.
Bright green? we already talked about this, but you've seen him in the Borat suit, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of hot guys, what? He might be hotter than you in the Speedo.
Oh, God, yeah. You've
seen You're ready for that.
Dad bod.
Stepdad bod versus dad bod.
What's the difference?
So dad bod, I don't know if he even has a dad bod. I think he's just kind of got a great body.
He's got a good body.
Yeah, dad bod's different than what he has, right?
Yeah.
You got the stepdad bod where it's like, I'm trying to, you know, I'm interested in chicks in their 30s and I'm, you know, I look good, but I'm not going to the gym every day. I got a business to run here. I got to get up and email my manager and apologize for everything I did last weekend, you know?
Yeah.
Get yelled at. Check my voicemails for all the things I did wrong.
Yeah.
And then he does the exact same thing.
Yeah, New York was lit because we had Bongiorno there and we had our agent.
I fucking love that guy.
Yeah, thank you, Hutch. And we got Hutch here too. We got the photography. We've got everything we need.
You know what's crazy about Bongiorno is... So whoever doesn't know, hasn't seen it yet, but he brought Bongiorno on stage because it was his birthday and did a whole rigmarole
for him. Happy birthday. Happy 50th, buddy.
Ernie played and
I got on stage.
Horse took his shirt off and grinded, whatever. But Bongiorno,
I kissed him on the mouth.
I think Bongiorno was like one of the best people you've just brought up on stage. He's so good up there. He was very comfortable. He was hamming it up
a little. Well, he was a drummer in a
punk band. So he's comfortable up there. Yeah,
he loves a stage.
Agents, they're salesmen. They're not scared of that.
They're not. Some of them are. I've seen some nerdy agents.
Yeah, they're like the ones in the email. They're the email agents. You know, they stay in the DMs.
Yeah.
But those are the guys, they know how to get the
money.
They
know how to make a good email.
Yeah.
That's a good.
Bongiorno, that guy could sell anything, I think. I like that guy.
He's just an honest guy. You know?
Yeah. It was just funny because before he on stage, he turned to me and goes, I have no clue what's going to happen. Like, kind of like fishing. Like, I would know. He goes, I have no clue what's going to happen. I go, you got me, man. Like, I don't know either. You know?
He said, Schwartz said, come to the side of the stage. He's like, I don't want to go. Please don't let me go.
That's not the worst
thing.
And
he's like, you don't have a choice.
Other agencies are very interested in us right now. So if you want to.
Shout out to Bonnie's.
That was hilarious when Schwartz took away your mushrooms and then you just had a second bag. fucking
He
funny.
Ran on stage, grabbed the mushrooms, and I just pulled out the other
and
bag.
Then he just ate them. He ate them all, plastic bag and all. He just ate the whole thing. It's fun when Brian comes out.
Right. I love it. Yeah, it's fun. I get nervous when the management comes out.
Why?
Because I know they already know what I do.
They work for you, buddy.
I know, but I still feel like I'm like. Bongiorno doesn't judge me as much as Schwartz does.
You know, based on what I've seen, I'm not going to get into details. I don't think he's really in a position to be judging.
Oh, I love it.
You know, they're not giving you 80%. You're giving them 20%. So I wouldn't be nervous.
But you still are a team.
I know. I'm just kidding a little bit.
What are you up to?
I'm just sitting.
What are you going to do when we're gone in Mexico?
Oh, yeah. You guys are going to Mexico. Are you excited?
I'm excited.
I'm going to chill in Boston for 3 days.
What are you going to do in Boston?
Chill, man. I got a little Airbnb. I'm just going to post up.
Why are you hanging out in Boston?
Because that's where we are. I didn't want to fly anywhere. It was cheaper just to do this.
So you got an Airbnb.
Yeah.
Are you going to sightsee by yourself?
Maybe. I haven't decided what I'm going to do yet.
You're going to have like random strangers take pictures of you up in different places?
Will you take a picture of me?
Just stern-faced.
That'd be kind of funny, right?
That would be funny.
If anybody lives in Boston, I'll still be here. This is coming out Tuesday, so I'll still be here for one more day. So hit me up if you got anything for me to do. I'll be lonely, but I'm good at it.
Man, these shows have been amazing. I was so proud of Brooklyn and Philly and D.C. I mean, East Coast is really fucking happening.
You guys been building these markets, huh?
Yeah, you said, what'd you say to me? You're like, all this.
I said,
maybe,
you guys are getting better. You're going to be a good band in a couple years. Couple more rehearsals with Floyd. You might
have
it
been
together.
Drinking a lot.
No, I said to you guys, it's going to be like this every show next year. I think you're going to, my prediction is you put out this album. It's a very good album. A couple really good songs on there. One in particular I really like.
Because you wrote it with me. Dumbass.
No, it's a good album, right? It's the most professional thing you've written, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's going to be good, and it's going to, you know, and I think that all the shit you've done through the pandemic is going to pay off. That's my prediction, and I've never been wrong in my life about anything, so.
Oh, man.
Except for my own career. I'm really good at other people's careers and telling what's going to happen. My own, usually I'm wrong.
All right. They want us to keep these openings under 20 minutes.
Who?
Just Mara Davis, all okay. The management.
I'll listen to Mara. I'm just making sure it wasn't fans.
No, fans.
Who cares what they think?
Shut up. No. Our fans want us
to... Tell everybody that my opening sets have been going good and they're good. So they can listen to my
music.
Okay,
you know what? I'm going to hype you up. It really has been really good, Nick.
Especially how much better it is than the beginning.
Yeah, well, you were still learning how to do the show.
Exactly, because It was like, oh, what am I doing?
I remember, like, the first two shows were like, hey, let's add the fucking voice, let's add this. And you started exploring it, and then I stopped telling you what you should add, and then you just started coasting in, and now it's great.
And I'm dialed in.
The best opener in the fucking business. Woo! Let's go! That's why he's opened the podcast and the show.
All I do is open, baby.
All I do is open.
I'm a B+.
You're an A-.
Let's go. I'll take it.
No one's perfect. Mm. There's some openers who are just trash.
Like who? I'm just kidding.
No, I'm just kidding. No, not like trash musically, but
here's
just
how,
like,
you become a good opener, guys.
All right.
You don't make it about you. That's the hard thing in this business. Everybody's trying to get higher on the poster, a little bigger font. You know what? You know what really helps your career? When you work with people and you work with them, they want you to work with them. Then they remember you and they want to work with you again. That's it. Just
That's
be normal.
Is.
Be a normal person.
Yeah.
How would you want someone to be when they open for you? Do that.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. But we've always been nice to as an opener, and now that we're headliners, you know, I just feel like we would love that too.
Yeah.
That's why I like picking my own openers now. I used to just have the venues pick the openers, and then it's like every band's different, it's a vibe, but like when you bring an opener on tour,
you never know what you're going to get. Like there's no rapport sometimes. Yeah, I get
That's why I like picking openers.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, but that's sad, though. That means you're not open.
Three more shows, and then we're never going to do music again, ever. We're going to just be apart.
We're going to still do this.
Hell yeah.
I'm in Denver. I mean, we can hang out.
No, we're going to hang out. We're friends.
Fuck you.
We're friends.
I know. We're going to Chicago.
Chicago.
We're going to the Laker game.
And my girlfriend's going.
And your girlfriend's going to stay in the hotel.
No, her best friend ever lives there. They're going to hang out all day while we go.
Oh, hell yeah. Is she hot?
She's married.
Damn it.
Engaged. Okay. But she is hot, yes.
I met this girl last night in North Carolina.
We'll keep it under 25, Mara.
She's from North Carolina. Yeah, two more minutes of us talking bullshit. I met this girl. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful, cool, southern girl. North
Ooh,
Carolina.
I love those southern
She's
girls.
Like, I didn't come to your show because Tina Turner Broadway was on. I'm like, respect.
Okay, I kind of fuck with that.
Fuck with that.
Yeah.
I fuck with that. Shout out to North Carolina. Being an honest.
North Carolina, come on a razor. Put your head up. Speak like a helicopter. There we go.
Yeah. All right, guys. Have a great week.
I like you
I'm
all.
I'm going to Mexico.
Get there fast and take it slow, baby.
Yeah. What happens with this man is when we could do these travel Europe and blah, 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 we binge the first, right when we get off the airplane.
Really?
We fucking binge it.
I'd be so scared to do that in a foreign country. I'm just kind of. I'm a nervous Nelly, though.
Oh, my God. Did I tell you this? I think I got time for this story. We were in Mexico.
Technically, your podcast, so.
Yeah, fuck it. I do what I want. And the Fleck interview isn't as long because he had to pick up his kids.
Plus, people love us. You know, we're an iconic duo.
Fuck yeah. We played in Mexico for a wedding.
Yeah.
And this is the Coke years. I won't say who bought Coke.
Sure.
But two of us bought Coke. And... from this dude, and then he followed us into the bathroom.
Oh, no.
Another guy followed us into the bathroom, and we were doing coke in, like, this club bathroom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They pound on the door. Hey, you're doing coke. You're not doing the coke. We have to sell you.
Oh, it's like.
So we had to buy coke twice, and then after we bought this, it was literally the same bags.
What a hustle.
It was a hustle, and they're like, now you can do cocaine in our room.
But then you were like, whatever. Then they didn't
fuck
with you.
Fuck this. We're out of here, dude.
We took the coke, right?
We definitely took the coke back to the resort. And all right, we're done.
They grifted you pretty hard there is what happened.
I got hustled.
Yeah.
Hustled.
That's all right. It happens.
But I respect. I mean, I respect that hustle.
It's like, you know, it's a stepping
stone. We're tourists.
Stone.
They're trying to get money from us. And we're the dummies trying
passage.
To buy illegal drugs in a different country.
Get there fast and take it slow, baby. You know what I'm saying?
That's why I was smuggling drugs into countries.
Oh, God. Don't talk about this in the podcast.
I don't do it anymore. I guess I did really have an epiphany.
Yeah,
I guess
that's
you're
stupid.
Right. I shouldn't be talking about me bringing mushrooms into different
That's
countries.
Absolutely dumb. Don't admit to committing a crime on a recording.
I mean, it's not a crime. Dad didn't get caught.
Oh my God. All right. That's it. Oh, end the podcast. Or end the opening. Brian, I tried, okay? I'm doing my best. I'm trying to make him an adult here. All he does is incriminate himself.
Yo, what if I run for office when I'm like 50?
You can't ever run. Well, maybe you could because you've been so open about everything. They can't. You'd be like, it'd be impossible for anyone to be like, this, he did this. He's like, everyone's like, yeah, he talked about it on his podcast like 300 times. They lift the curtain. It's just like, yeah, we know. That's all right. Why we're here.
Hey, Floyd, do you want to be the motivational speech for this week to tell everyone to have a great week? Come here. Come
give
here.
Give them a motivational speech.
Tell everyone why they're going to have a great week. But you got to get close. You can't just do it from the fucking couch. Come on, get closer. Ladies and gentlemen, Floyd Kellogg with the motivational speak before we get Mr. Fleck up here, who was a wonderful man, and it was really a great interview, and I loved it, so enjoy. Floyd, take the mic.
You know, like, every day doesn't have to be amazing and shit. Just fucking...
What's up with the pessimism? Okay, what is it?
So, you know, just live your life and...
Fuck
you.
Yeah.
You know, when you wake up in the morning, you just go, like count backwards from 10, and then just, like, get up and just start moving. Give it a try.
Why do you sound depressed right now? Are you okay?
That's all.
Hold on. This is a real joke. Are you sad?
No, I'm like one beer deep, and I think I got like the shampoo effect from last night.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going there with you then, cowboy.
Like all the alcohol you drank from last night, all of a sudden it just like triggers, like you get right back there.
I did that with mushrooms last night because I've been binging them last couple days, and you take one of them, and all of a sudden... All right, I got two mics in my hand. I got to go. We got to go do a sound check.
Everything doesn't have to be good. If everything's amazing, nothing's amazing. Bye.
All right, shut up. I love you guys. Have a great week. Be safe out there. Let everyone know that you're here to kick ass. And enjoy my talk with Bela. He's the man, dude. You're going to love this one. All right, bye. All right, next up on the interview hour, we have Mr. Bela Fleck. Yes, big show tonight. He's one of the best banjo players that's ever been and on this earth. Hey, Chris, play some Bela. The man's won 14 Grammys. He is an inspiration to all the young cats playing bluegrass and playing instrumental music. He's just... one of the best musicians on the planet. I would proudly say that. So, ladies and gentlemen, we talked about it a lot. We talked about quarantine. We talked about what it takes to perfect a craft like he has. And we talked about a little bit of fatherhood. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the interview hour, Mr. Bela Fleck. How you doing, sir?
Very good. And you?
I'm doing well. Where are you at right now?
Nashville, Tennessee, home of the Grand Ole Opry.
How's it out in Nashville?
Soggy.
Is it?
Yeah. A little soggy.
You know, let's get into this. I want to know, I have a lot, you know, you play with a lot of my friends and stuff, and you're just such a legend in my scene, and I just see how much of an influence you are to, like, guys like Billy Strings and Green Sky Bluegrass and stuff, and I can't wait to talk to the source of it all. Like, where you're from? New York City?
I am.
What part?
I am. Manhattan.
You grew
up on the street in West End.
What made you inspire to play banjo?
It is the weirdest thing. I heard it. I was visiting my grandparents in Queens one morning, and the Beverly Hillbillies came on television, and it was Earl Scruggs. And you know, if you're going to be a banjo player, Earl Scruggs turns the key, you know, and people that are going to be banjo players, they hear Earl Scruggs and boom, they got to go find a banjo. So anyway, ever since I heard him on the Beverly Hillbillies, I was a banjo person. I loved the banjo, but I never told anybody because it was too weird, you know, New York City.
Especially in the city, you know, you're in Manhattan playing the banjo.
Yeah, but so then eventually one just fell into my lap by the time I was about 15. My grandfather, I was playing guitar, and I liked it okay. You know, I was like interested in music. But when I got the banjo, my grandfather got me one because he saw I was playing guitar. He said, oh, maybe you'd like this. And he got it like from a garage sale, just a cheap one.
Uh-huh.
And that was a whole different story. I went from a kid who was like, you know, interested in music to being like a psycho type A practicing freak, you know, got cold sweats without the instrument near me. It was like very, very profound change. And so in about 3 years of playing, I got, you know, a long, long way. But then I was also hearing the music of, this would have been, you know, the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
In New York City, there was, you know, the fusion era was cooking. There was, you know, Weather Report. There was John McLaughlin. There was Chick Corea and Return to Forever. There was Miles Davis, you know, had already done his Bitches Brew stuff. There was a salsa. There was reggae. I liked it all. I just happened to like the banjo. It wasn't even country music. I didn't even like country music. I just liked the sound of the banjo.
Because you really did transform the banjo into a completely, you made it into your own sound, which is beautiful. And who is your mentor growing up to teach you to like go outside of the box?
Yeah, I was always interested in anything, you know, different. And then I found like the most different cat on the banjo is a guy named Tony Trischka.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony's he's not only, you know, the most creative guy that's ever picked the banjo up, in my opinion. He's one of the most wonderful people you could possibly meet. And he was from upstate New York. There seemed to be a tendency for, you know, wildly modernist banjo players coming out of New York area, New York State. There's a guy named Bill Keith who is also a New York guy who you know, also transformed the banjo in his way. And Tony kind of took it from there, and he did a much more kind of primitive, wild, jammy kind of style of banjo at a very, very high level. And he became my teacher. And so I was very encouraged by what he did. He was just doing things and, you know, playing with in different keys with people, with saxophones, with drums. It was coming more out of a 60s, you know, be yourself, do your own thing kind of a framework, rather than like, I'm going to be a jazz musician or I'm going to be a classical musician. He just was a wide-ranging talent and still is.
How did you meet all those boys, like Woon and stuff?
The Flecktone guys?
Yeah.
They showed up later on. So like I originally got really inspired by, you know, people doing new things with their instruments. I was just curious. I wanted to learn music, but I wanted to learn it on the banjo. People would say, why don't you learn to play the saxophone if you want to play jazz? Or why don't you learn to play the piano? I was like, I play the banjo. That's what I want to play. Now, why do I have to learn some other instrument to play this? So the more I would learn, the more I would sort of incorporate it into things I was writing. But I always felt like I needed to be in a band. I didn't want to just be some guy in his house working on his music, trying to get people to do his music. I wanted to be part of bands. So I was always in bluegrass bands because that was the only place I could work. And I eventually landed a great job with a band called the Newgrass Revival in the 80s with Sam Bush. And that led me kind of really to the top of the bluegrass world in terms of the virtuoso players, the people like Tony Rice and Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas, Mark O'Connor, the sort of cats, the A-team of sort of creative bluegrass cats. And so we started, you know, an enclave here in Nashville where we would get together and do things. But meanwhile, I kept trying to make records with the bluegrass cats, and they would always go, man, this stuff's just too complicated. Why don't you just simplify it, you know?
Yeah.
You're like, I don't want to simplify it. I want to do this stuff. And then I met Victor Wooten and Howard Levy, and they were like, oh, that's nice. Got any more? You know? You can make it more complicated if you want. And so all of a sudden I had these guys that were like really interested in, you know, challenging themselves in a different way. And it's not that the bluegrass guys weren't. They were, you know, really good at that, but it was just a lot. I was asking a lot. And basically I was working up to, you know, the Flecktones, finding a way to pull the banjo out of bluegrass altogether into a whole different world, you know.
Yeah, totally. Like, what's the difference between playing with a guy like Sam Bush and playing with a guy like Victor Wooten?
Well, I can tell you what's the same about them.
Yeah, that'd be great.
They both make it feel really good. They both they make you want to play,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Like playing with a great drummer. Tony Rice was that way too, the guitar player. He would just create a bed and you could just do anything. The way his rhythm was so encouraging and solid and precise and inspiring. And Sam Bush has that rhythmic. He has the rhythm of a great drummer, and the, you know, the way he plays rhythm is incredible. And he's a great soloist too. Victor has that way of enabling everyone around him. He gets up, he just sort of blends in like water and finds a way to bubble underneath you and make you, you know, comfortable and inspired. you know?
Yeah, that's beautiful. I want to go back to something you said where you said you were getting cold sweats without your banjo. Did you have like a high stake of anxiety when you were a kid?
Well, I came from a broken family, so I don't know that I was all that anxious. It was just that I had this weird compulsion when I finally got the banjo. Up until then, I would say I was pretty mellow, pretty easygoing about mm-hmm. things. Maybe my family would say that's not true, but I always thought I was the mellow one that didn't freak out. It became my lifeline all through high school. And I would, you know, everybody would, hey, but let's get together. Let's go hang out after school. I'd be like, I got to get back to the banjo. I got to get back. Everybody thought I was crazy, including me. But I couldn't put it down. It was a real compulsion. I was really fascinated by it.
When you're realizing I'm getting really good at this thing, did you full on dive into your dreams, or was it scary to get into your dreams when you're first starting?
I always tried. You know, I like to get together with people who knew things that I didn't and try and learn from them, whether it was a jazz pianist or a rock guitar player or somebody who played jazz flute at school or things like that. And I always imagined someday trying to do, you know, David Grisman had a band. He was a mandolin player, actually did a lot of stuff with Jerry Garcia later on. But he had put together a band called the Grisman Quintet. And he actually made it onto the jazz charts doing his own, you know, kind of gypsy jazz, bluegrass music. And so I was inspired by the fact that it could be done because I'd seen him do it. So I thought, I want to do that with the banjo. I want to take the banjo and really, but I really wanted to become a jazz musician, but I didn't realize how hard it was going to be. And I wasn't, you know, as good on the banjo as saxophone players were on the saxophones and right. jazz guitar players were on guitar. I just didn't have the information. I hadn't been schooled. So just bit by bit, I was learning and learning on the sly while I was in bands in bluegrass. And by the time I met Victor Wooten, I still wasn't a jazz musician, but I had a lot of tools in my toolbox. You know, I had a lot of personality of myself, mm-hmm. you know, like I couldn't go play bebop for a living, but I could bebop could influence my bluegrass, you know, bluegrass could influence my jazz, and the funk I could get in there with the funk, some funky guys, and you know, hold my own somewhat.
Yeah.
So I mean, the whole pot of everything that I had made me, I guess, attractive enough to those guys to be interested in what I did for Future Man and Victor and Howard. And then I had all these tunes that I'd been writing all this time, and I couldn't find anybody to play them because they were just a little bit too involved for a bluegrass ensemble to play.
Yeah.
At the time.
Do you believe in, like, you are an open vessel when music comes into you, or do you believe that it just takes work and it takes patience to start writing great songs?
I think you have to, well, in terms of the writing or in terms of improvising, those are different kind of questions. But
let's talk about both sides.
Okay. As far as improvising, if you work hard enough on the technical part and then create room, then you can be kind of like a vessel. You know, things can start to happen that are not planned, that are better than what you could have planned, and that might surprise you. But it takes a lot of work, like hard knuckle bruising work, to get to the point where that can happen. It's not just automatic, and it's not consistent. It doesn't happen every day. So, I mean, you could get to a point where, and you know the music well enough that you're playing, that you could have a very, very spontaneous time and things could just stop, you know, just be flowing. But if you got uptight or anxious at all, that would stop the flow. So you really had to have, to be professional instrumentalist, you'd really have to have, once again, a toolkit full of things you could do when you weren't a vessel.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing was coming. You were, well, okay, well, I've got lick 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've got this, this, and this. And people might not even know I'm not a vessel today.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, I think that's the thing about becoming a consistent performing musician. You have to be good whether you're, you know, whether you think it's flowing or not. And then the other thing I've discovered over the years is that sometimes you think you're just on fire, and when you listen back and it doesn't sound that great. And sometimes you think you're sucking and you listen back and it sounds great. So all of this is about perception as well.
Yeah. And like how you're dealing with your emotions for that day when you're listening back?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I record, I like to just over record and come back another day and decide what happened. Not try to like go, oh, well, this is the take, so we better fix it. Because that, when you're improvising and playing, you're in a whole different space. And if you're the person who has to make these decisions, it's very hard to switch from the open, except, like, you ever heard about how people do comedy improv?
Yeah.
Nobody can ever say, oh, well, that's a bad idea. I'm not going to respond to that. You have to accept everything that happens.
Yeah.
That's the way the improv is going to work. If you start saying, well, I'm not buying that, whatever the other person does, you block the improv. It's the same thing musically. If you block, if you start judging your ideas or the ideas of the people around you while you're improvising, you're just going to shut off the flow. You're going to turn off the tap. So, you know, you just have to accept everything and embrace it when you're improvising.
You ever have a dry spell where the tap was shut off?
Yeah.
How long did it last?
Well, I mean, it's more of a momentary thing. It's more of a, I've discovered it's kind of like sap. If you put your instrument down for a couple of weeks and come back, there'll be a lot of musical sap sitting there waiting for you. Like, you'll have ideas again. But if you're playing constantly, and this is what's not fair about it, your technique will be really, really good, but you won't have a lot of ideas because you're already trying everything. You can play anything you could think of, but you can't think of anything because you're just kind of like burned out, you know? So you have to actually leave space. It's a curious balance between, you know, playing a ton and not playing. I had this experience with Marcus Roberts, a great jazz musician. You know about him?
No, tell me about him.
Oh, my God. He's just one of the great jazz pianists. He played in Wynton's band, Wynton Marsalis's band for many years, and he's a blind player. And we were touring together doing kind of a jazz with the banjo kind of thing. It was really hip cat. And anyway, he couldn't practice all the time because he played piano. You know, so he'd be in the hotel room and he'd have to show up on the bandstand. We'd be playing a jazz, you know, club for five nights or something, two sets a night. And he'd get out and he just plays so great, he wouldn't even be able to warm up. You know, he just have to just come out there. And and one day he said to me, Bailey, you practice a lot, don't you? And I said, yeah, I guess I do. And he said, because I'm in the next room and I can hear you practicing. He said, I want you to try something. I said, well, what? And he said, try not practicing tomorrow. Don't practice and see what you play like on the stage. I was like, well, I don't know about that because, you know, I'm not good enough to play with you. You know, I've got to work on stuff to play with you. He said, just try it just for a day, you know, just see what happens. And sure enough, I got on stage and the ideas were flowing. I mean, I couldn't believe how much leaving a space had allowed the spontaneity to happen. And I think about people like, I'm thinking of Herbie Hancock, who says that improvising is like, is all about faith, that something will come to fill in the space. If you leave it empty and don't plan anything, something good is gonna show up right when you need it.
That's beautiful.
Another guy who talks about that is Bobby McFerrin. And his point of view, it's great on an On Being Krista Tippett show. He's talking with her and he says, jazz improvisation is all about don't stop. Don't look behind you. Don't think about what you just did. Keep going forward. Don't judge. Just go.
Isn't that life too?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there's certainly room for introspection and study of what's happened and what's gone wrong, but you just don't do it when you're performing.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Yeah.
What about, you know, this music industry is very hard on everyone. And, you know, like you said, like it just takes so much and you're playing every day. Like, do you remember a point in your career where you're just so burnt out that you just didn't want to be part of this anymore?
No.
That's great.
So no, I just feel so privileged to get to do it, you know, and to the kind of people I get to play with. Like if I'm going to go on tour with a Marcus Roberts or I'm going to get to go play with Chick Corea or I'm going to get to play with Zakir Hussain or Victor Wooten or Sam Bush and, you know, or an orchestra or my wife, Abigail, you know, or these bluegrass guys I'm about to go out and tour with. I'm not in the position to complain.
Yeah. Have you ever gotten into any like addictions or anything like that through this whole process?
Banjo addiction.
That's addiction.
That's the main one. I mean, you know, I would try things, but I never got, I never really, it never turned me on. It was more because it was going on. Mm-hmm. You know, things would be happening. I'd be like, oh, I don't know. Generally, I wouldn't call myself, you know, clean as a whistle, but I would lean in that direction.
No,
just because I'm clearer that way and I make better decisions. For instance, we used to get high sometimes and jam and stuff and like pot, you know, and you'd think it was so great and then you'd hear it back and it's like you had to be high to think it was great. It didn't sound that great when you were clear, yeah. You know, so I don't know. I like the straight up, you know, this is what's real.
Yeah.
And kind of being on the same plane. But I think everybody has a right to do what they want as long as they don't hurt anybody else. And gosh, take care of themselves, you know,
totally.
Make wise choices.
okay to feel burnt out and take a break, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, I got a big break here. You know, the pandemic gave me a big break in a way.
Yeah. What were you doing for it?
Well, I'm with my family. Like, I have these kids, you know?
Yeah.
You know, just being home. I mean, it's the first time I've been home in my whole, ever since I was 17 and I left home to start touring and stuff. I've never just been home for this long. But I had a lot of nice stuff to do in the basement. I had a Chick Corea duo album that we hadn't finished that we were, you know, sending mixes back and forth, edits. And I had this bluegrass album that just came out to work on. It was all recorded, but not edited or mixed. And I had things to do with my wife and live performances. So we did a lot from home, but we didn't have to go anywhere.
You talk about being on the road since you were 17. Is it hard to be a father and a husband?
It is. Music is by nature a bit narcissistic. I mean, you have to think that what you're doing is important and means something, but all of a sudden it doesn't mean as much as, you know, a kid who's got a dirty diaper, you know.
That's very true. You know what I mean? Totally.
So for me, it's been a little bit of maybe putting it back into perspective of, like, for me, I always said when I had kids, I joined the human race, because up until then, I could sort of walk around thinking that what I was doing was real important and I was super special. And, you know, I always tried to not be that way, but inevitably it's, you know, people applaud for you enough, you're going to start to, you know, take your privilege here and there, you know.
Marinating your own shit a little bit.
Marinating your old shit, yeah. So at any rate, it's been really good for that. It's been good for me putting it in perspective. But sometimes the music almost takes a backseat to things, and there's a point where I have to go, no, you know, I actually should be making sure I'm playing enough to still be good in another 5 years. Now I'm in my 60s.
Yeah.
It's always a balance, but it's been great to really be with these kids at the age that they're at.
How old are they?
3.5 and 8.5.
Whoa. Yeah, you're really in it.
It was a questionable decision, but now we're in it, and it's the greatest and the most complicated.
Being 60 and having young kids, what are the difficulties you see in yourself being a parent?
My energy's different. I mean, how old are you?
I'm 33.
33, yeah. So you're like a little more than half my age. I'm 63. So it's just that your energy, you just don't have endless energy. Yeah. In your 60s, and your body doesn't, and your body hurts inevitably. By the time you're in your 60s, something's going to hurt. So it might be your hips, it might be your back, you know. So, but you know, that doesn't matter if something's got to get picked up or somebody's got to be, you know, something's got to get done. You got to do it anyway. And so I think it's made me stronger and younger. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's been great for me.
Do you regret not having kids younger now that you're older, having young ones?
I never would have had kids if it wasn't for meeting a person who I thought would that would be wise.
Yeah.
So in other relationships I was in, it never seemed to be on the table for me anyway. And it wasn't until when I met Abby, it was clear to me that she really wanted to have kids. So if I was going to get to be with her, I had to agree to that. And it was worth it in this case. I was like, well, if you're willing to be with me, I'm willing to have kids. You know, that was the deal. And she's 19 years younger than me. And I've never been the kind of guy who dated younger girls or anything like that. It was just one of these things, you know. We just clicked. And it's been it's the greatest relationship in my life, you know, I've ever had. And I've had some great relationships, you know, with the musicians. This is a real partnership.
Let's go, Baylor. Fall in love, baby, at 60. Let's get it, bud. No, I love it. I mean, because
we've been together 20 years now, so it's not like,
that's awesome. Yeah, because I'm just kind of scared to have a relationship and I feel like it's gonna like ruin my path. Like,
right.
Do you have any advice on that?
Yeah. Well, that was my worry, and I was like, well, I always thought if I ever had kids, I would never feel great about going on the road again because I don't be leaving them behind.
Yeah,
and that has proven to be true. Now, when I go out on the road, it's bittersweet. I have to keep the trip shorter. Their well-being is more important than my project of the month or of the year. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in my case, I was lucky to find somebody who wanted to do it, and the age difference worked in my favor. Mm-hmm. That I could have that because in my 40s, I mean, I was full on with the Flecktones. We were doing 200 plus days a year.
That's crazy.
And I just, that would be a terrible thing to do to a kid, mm-hmm. to be a parent when you're that busy. But the truth is, if I didn't do anything else, the world would continue to turn. You know what I mean?
I got a question. Like, what did you learn about yourself during the quarantine as you're becoming more like a father during this whole period?
Well, I mean, honestly, this would go back into the narcissistic direction, which is that I realized I really do have to be doing a certain amount of music or I don't feel good at all. Mm-hmm. That I have to attend to my own concerns as well as the families and everything else that's important. And so that it was actually critical to me, to my mental health.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you asked me whether I, you know, why I was so wiggy as a teenager, I really think maybe there were some things that it solved for me. It made me feel better about myself. I knew I was into this thing. I was fascinated by it. As I started getting better at it, it was a reward. I got a reward. I got some Seroton or whatever it is. What is it where it gives you a buzz? Your brain gives you a buzz for certain things. Serotonin, is that it?
Yeah.
It was like I got a buzz from playing. I would be proud of myself when I played. I felt like the world made sense when I played, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it kept me, and then I was just super busy for, you know, 30 years or whatever doing it. So I never had time to think about a lot of other stuff.
Did you feel like you were being selfish?
Oh, during the quarantine? Oh, yeah. I was doing, you know, a lot of good around that. I just realized that I had to make sure I couldn't not play for months. It didn't work. Or I couldn't not have things that I cared about in my career or my music too. I had to attend to a certain amount of that. But as long as I did a little bit every week, you know, and did enough, then I felt fine. And I was thrilled to be mostly a dad and a husband. And there's a lot of stuff to navigate through this, you know.
I bet. And I mean, it seems like you changed your complete mind state about what is important to you, you know?
Yeah. And I knew it was going to happen, but I mean, the music is still important to me, and I still want to excel, and I can't be good at it unless I play a certain amount. You know, it's not the kind of stuff you could, like, take 3 months off of it and then go do a gig. Your hands aren't going to perform at the level that I expect mine to. I need to be playing a certain amount. So I think as we go forward, it's not going to be maybe as much as it used to be. You know, but it's still going to be enough to keep in shape and still feel that passion. And that passion is okay. It's supposed to be. That's my contribution to the world, is that stuff. Aside from my being a parent, that's what I have to offer. So it's not like that should go away just because I'm raising kids. I should show them where my passion is and that it's important to care about things. I don't want to teach them to give up their lives when they have kids, you know, give up their hopes and dreams when they have kids. I want to teach them to figure out how to make it all work together as best as they can.
Totally. And I totally agree with that. And, you know, going into that whole idea of just keep creating, are awards important to you?
That's a tricky answer. And back into the narcissism part, because, you know, when someone gives you a Grammy, you know, you can't help. Yeah, Grammys are cool. You know, they gave me a Grammy then. Yeah. And then if you're not winning, the people that I know who never get nominated or win think the Grammys are a load of crap. You know, what I mean?
It's like you can't even talk about it.
Can't win. Yeah. So, but no, I mean, it's just a nice feeling when I have to admit that it's nice when someone recognizes what you do. But you also have to understand that a lot of other people who might do something way better than you didn't get recognized. So you have to keep in mind that an award is kind of a popularity contest. You might be getting the award because you did a good job of getting the word out about your music, which may be as good as some other people's music who weren't as good at getting the word out, weren't willing to go on the road, the music somehow didn't capture people's imagination. And so that's the popularity piece of it. And unfortunately, that's necessary to have a career.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, it's like you can be great in a closet, but no one will know about it. And some people are fine with that. But I always wanted to do well. I think I had a chip on my shoulder, again, from coming from a broken home and wanting to prove that I was worthwhile.
Yeah.
So that's where the drive comes from, I think.
Totally. And you talk about this broken home again. Was it a bad breakup? Was it a divorce or did...
Yeah, breakup. So what happened is my mother and my father split up when I was like either one or one and a half.
Oh, wow.
And then he was just gone. He was not to be found. I didn't meet him until I was in my 40s. So it wasn't...
What?
Yeah, I had to go find him. He wasn't interested. And so it was one of those kind of deals. So it wasn't like he was there with a bad vibe. It's more like Darth Vader is standing around somewhere, but you can't find him. You know, there's a bad guy somewhere that is your father, you know. And he was very unpopular in my family, like in my mother's side of the family. So, you know, you always hear terrible things about him. And then, you know, at some point I had to go meet him just to sort of defang him in my mind.
What was that like? Like, what was that's
it was
gotta,
very intense, very intense.
Was it heavy? Like, did you guys, did he want to talk to you or did he not want to talk to you or?
He was willing to talk to me under certain, you know, certain conditions. You know, he needed to feel safe too. So, yeah, I just went. I went and found him one day at where he taught at a college in Maryland. And yeah, I don't mind talking about it. It's not. Like I'm saying, going to meet him took a lot of the poison out of the situation for me. And we had a warm enough. I won't say friendship, but we knew each other and had several meetings. I knew him over several years. Now he's gone now. And, you know, there's nothing, all the, what do you want to call it? The poison is out of the wound at this point and it's healed up. And it was good that I went to meet him and got him. But he was never going to turn into as important a person to me as my stepfather, mm-hmm. my mother married when I was 7, who never really became like my father, but he was a great dude.
Yeah. Do you see anything in yourself that you saw in your actual dad?
Yeah, I do. Like I do. What? I think he's in my brother, my older brother. There's just a certain personality, sort of a cool kind of coolness, sort of an emotionally a little distant sometimes, introspective. He was a narcissist, so that was a good thing to learn about. You know, I'm not saying I'm any more of a narcissist than a lot of my friends, but it's all something to be aware of as a musician. Yeah. I've used that word a lot in this interview.
Do you think narcissism ruins creativity?
No, sometimes it gives you like the fuel you need to like believe so intensely. And then you were able to create something great because you just believed. And at some point later in your life, you may realize that that was cool, but you're a better human being if you don't believe you're right all the time or that everything you do is special, you know, even if it is special. Everybody's, you know, contributions are special. But we got to treat each other well, you know?
Yeah, totally. I want to talk about your mentors outside of music. Do you have any people in your life that really taught you how to live?
You know, Tony Trischka was a hero to me, and it was always the people I was in bands with who were my brothers and my, you know, my family and inspiration, and then other musicians that I would, you know, aspire to. Sometimes you meet somebody and you love their music so much, but you find out they're not really such great people, or they're not nice to you, or you know what I mean. So
totally.
I've learned that it doesn't necessarily come together, but you have special relationships and you click with certain people and. Infatuations, if you will, with certain musicians or whatever. Special friendships. I mean, I learned so much from Victor Wooten, you know,
What did he teach you about life? Like, he seems like he's very present, focused on, you know, living a life that's full.
Yeah, he's a very good person. His intentions are very pure, and he's a team player. We sat around and talked for years, you know, and he and his brothers, all of the Wooten brothers are kind of marvelous thinkers and very inspiring people to be around on every level. And of course, on the musical level, you could sit around and talk abstract music theory for days.
Wow.
Until your head is spinning. But on the other end, you could talk about humanity and, you know, the experience they've lived in being black guys and in this culture and their approach to it. You know,
what they teach about humanity?
I don't know how to explain it. It's like Victor has a way of like putting up with the things he put up with as a black guy and not being blameful to anybody about it, which is very kind of unusual and special. Future Man is kind of like a what do you call it when somebody believes in crazy stuff, you know, a theorist, conspiracy theorist, but almost all of the conspiracies that he came up with to tell us about proved to be true. You know,
oh my God.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know those guys. So, I mean, crazy.
Just really out, apparently in left field, but not actually. Actually very tapped into what's going on. And Howard also, he's like great. You know, just great dudes, really smart, all in different ways. I'm talking about the Flecktones now, but I learned a lot from my bluegrass pals too. Like guys like Jerry Douglas was like a big brother to me, and Sam Bush, of course, as a band leader, how he treated people and what he expected was great, a great, great learning experience.
Were you ever close with Jeff Austin?
We were friendly.
Friendly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We did some tours together with the Flecktones and Yonder, and he had that big energy, you know. You could really connect with him in a certain way, and just vibe, you know. It was really, he was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And maybe harder to be around if you were around him all the time for some of the people. Yeah. But for me, it would always be a glancing thing, and I'd be like, well, that was really fun guy to like just spark with.
Yeah,
very excited about life. I was really surprised about what happened to him.
Did you ever go through any depression throughout your years?
Not really. I've been pretty even.
That's
honestly
good.
And I surround myself with people who are kind of even, generally speaking, as much as possible. Again, Flecktones, very, very chill bunch of guys. So I can't say we had a foul word in, you know, 30 years.
Wow. You know, no fights, little, no punch outs, nothing?
Never.
That's amazing. I'm a clap to that.
The only thing that would sometimes happen, like with Future Man, I remember I would like not be judgmental and not, you know, say much about what anybody played until the record. So people get used to like doing their own thing. But all of a sudden I'd be like, oh my God, this is it. If we don't, you know, get it exactly the way I need it, I want it to be now, then that's it. I lost my chance. So now's the time to speak up. So all of a sudden on records, I would become kind of domineering.
Yeah.
You know? And Future Man didn't like that. One thing about him is he does not like being told what to do, or even, you know, he wants to do his own thing. And that's why he's such a great musician. And 9 times out of 10, maybe more, he's going to come up with something better than I ever could have suggested.
Yeah.
But I would definitely get, you know, more forceful and more, you know, well, this is the time. We got to do this way. It's just, you know, and then the rest of the time I'd be hands off.
Yeah.
Like a gig didn't matter, but the record mattered to me because I was producing it too. So so we had a few run-ins in that way, but we got over them and moved on, and it wasn't too bad. Everybody was trying to do the best they could and do the right thing. This, everybody thought the right thing was a little different. So there was a little bit of that.
Why do you put more pressure on yourself on records versus live performances?
Well, I think live performance is supposed to be spontaneous and open, and a record is kind of like the photograph of what a thing is.
Yeah.
Like, so to me, I don't want to go in and record stuff that's not realized. I want records to be realized and final and really be correct. It's one chance to get stuff right that you can't. Like live, you can't put it under the microscope and figure out why we always mess up this transition, or why so-and-so doesn't really know how to play through those changes. Maybe it's me, of the middle of the form of the song, or we keep missing this thing here. And live, you know, it goes by, you know. But on a record, that's a chance to get it right. And if you get it right on the record, you're going to start getting it right live that much more. So I might always think, God, I wish that was a backbeat there, but he always wants to play that as a set of three, you know, in three. But gosh, on the record, I really want to hear it that way. It was just a chance to kind of get it the way I wanted it.
And the final say on records?
With the Flecktones, you know, I found there were ways to get it the way I wanted that didn't involve putting anybody through that.
Yeah.
You know, as the years went by and editing became more of a thing, I discovered we could like, well, let's try it three ways, you know. We're going to be playing this song for 5 hours or something. Let's try the chorus with a, you know, with a big fat beat. Well, let's try it with a lot of subdivision. Let's try this. Let's see what we get. Mm-hmm. And then generally everybody would leave and I would be the one assembling it, and I could make my choice, and then they'd come back and listen. Mm-hmm. And either they agreed with my choice or they'd say, listen, I don't think that works. Let me change this. And then that was a dialogue. That's
totally
a good dialogue. So it worked out. I thought it worked pretty well. But there's one funny thing that would happen. People would say, oh, your records are too slick. You know, even though we would play it that slick in shows eventually, and the band would hear that, people would say, oh, you know, you should let the records be more loose, you know.
Yeah.
And so one album, everyone came in and said, well, we need to be more loose. And so, okay, let's be more loose. Okay. So we did a bunch of takes. Everybody left. I put something together. I didn't clean it all up. You know, I didn't fix, I didn't go after, I didn't go searching through the takes for the place we did this perfect or that perfect. Or I left some hair on it, you know. And Victor came in, he said, oh yeah, this is much better. Much, now I got to fix this, and this. And then we fixed all the things he didn't like in it. Future Man came in, he said, oh yeah, this is much, much more raw, much, much better. Now, the drums are rushing here. I didn't get the right sticks down here. And so they all did all the things that I would have done if they weren't in the room. Every single person wanted their part to be good. They couldn't hear a problem with anyone else's part that was a little loose, but if it's your own part, you want it to be right.
Yeah.
So it was a very instructive moment, you know, that I realized, okay, I don't know that we can we can honor that request for it to be loose, because everybody really wants to get their part right. And once you do that, it's not loose anymore. It's slick. And the band was capable of that kind of slick. It wasn't slick crappy. It was slick, like we got everything. We were trying some hard stuff and we got it right.
And it's also kind of like they just want to have a say in it, maybe.
Oh, yeah. I don't know that it was that.
No?
I think everybody was quite comfortable with, you know, their say was all over the music. They were, you know, they just did everything. Sometimes it's good to have an editor, a person who, you know, you try 20 things. Now you got 20 things to decide. Well, maybe somebody can listen to it all and say, I think this is the best. And then they can come back and say, yeah, can I hear a few of those other options? Oh, you're right. That is the best. Or,
yeah.
And we always had that kind of, it wasn't like I made everybody do it my way, but generally there was a lot of comfort with the fact that at least it wasn't an outside producer. Things that the band really seemed to like is like, it was us doing it. It was me. If it was a mistake, it was our mistake.
Yeah. And the slick thing about it was 14 Grammys, baby. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. That's slick.
I need one of those.
Hey, Bela, thank you so much for your time. I know you got to get out of here. I got one last question for you and I'll let you go. What do you want to be remembered by?
My breath. No, I don't know. depends who's doing the remembering. I don't know. I don't think about that.
No?
Should I be thinking about that?
I don't know. I mean, you still have like at least 75 more years of life left, so.
Probably so, yeah. Especially if we freeze me for a while or parts of me.
Like Austin Powers.
Yeah. We just freeze part of me. I don't know. You know, I think I've always tried to be really, you know, the best I could be on the banjo. You know, and so I think, you know, I've seen people who played at a level that it changed how people thought about that instrument, you know, or maybe there was now a level that people tried to get to. And I think I played a part in that with the banjo, about trying to really be excellent and really taking it real serious. I think that I've had a few good tunes along the way. I wouldn't mind people caring about what I've written, but, you know, writing is very personal and supposed to express yourself, and it doesn't necessarily mean everyone else is going to like it. So I'd hope people think that I thought I was honest about my music and idealistic about it.
Well, it sounds beautiful. Keep inspiring the youth. I know how my friends, my group is, you are the legend to them. And we just love seeing you keep making music and keep striving for perfection. So thanks, Bela. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Have a great time with your kids, bud. Enjoy that time, okay. Dude.
I'll see you.
Later, bud. Later.
It's a lot.
Bye. Ah, Bela Fleck. Cool. That was cool. I get nervous when guys are very serious because I'm like, oh, fuck, can't really talk about shit I want to talk about sometimes. And he actually opened up about it. I didn't know that about his father. He didn't see his father till he was 40. Damn, that must be fucking heavy. So shout out to Bela. Nice job, buddy. Thank you for being on the show. All right, guys. Catch you on the tail end. All right. Thanks, Bela. I really appreciate that conversation. Next up, I want to close the show with an amazing guitar player out of Denver, Colorado. His name is Taylor Scott. He's up and coming in the scene. He's getting on all the festivals, but I really think you're going to enjoy him. His playing is unbelievable. I really want to give this guy a stage for him to talk about his music. So, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy my closing with one of my new favorite guitar players, Taylor Scott. Denver's own. Are you from Denver?
Not really, but I've been here since I was 21.
Okay, cool.
Who's from Denver? You
know? Who is from Denver? You're true. I got Taylor Scott. What's up, dog?
Good to see you, man.
Let's go. One of the best young fucking guitar players out there. And I'm I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. I really do think you're one of the best guitar players out there.
I appreciate it, man. I'm trying.
Tell me your story. What happened? Who possessed you? Well, how'd you get this good?
I don't know, man. I'm just trying to work on it, get a little bit better. But I'm from St. Louis originally, and then grew up in Wyoming after that.
Okay.
So there was no blues music, funk music, soul music, jazz music in Wyoming. You know what I mean?
Oh, fuck. So when you were developing your art, you were in Wyoming.
Right. So I have a weird thing, and it was like, I'm 28, so it was right when the YouTube shit was coming around. So I was able to find some of that stuff. But there's one record store in Cheyenne where I grew up. So there wasn't there wasn't a lot of that scene going on. So I found all of it through just listening to the greats, and then started just playing in the basement. You know what I mean? But I got so into blues music when I was pretty young.
Yeah, who 13. Was your guy?
B.B. King. And I've actually been going back and revisiting that stuff.
What do you hear now that you're a better guitar player than you did when you were a kid?
Well, I'm listening through chronologically, starting with his earliest record, which really, those were just all singles that they compiled, at the time. But I hear his style started with super T-Bone Walker kind of bass, and then he started, it took years for him to develop that real singing, melodic, vocal type of style on the guitar with the vibrato and the bending. And then, I don't know, it just kind of has struck me that dude was great from the get-go, but how many years it actually took him, even that he was putting records out and was famous, to actually sound like the B.B. King that we kind of think of.
Oh, so younger stuff didn't really sound like that typical B.B. King sound
yet? Yeah, you can hear it, but it's way more impressionistic of T-Bone Walker and stuff like that. So I thought that was so interesting, because we pressure ourselves to be figure out who we are. Yeah. Super early on.
It's such bullshit, that pressure.
I know,
as a younger. Because how do you know what your sound is when you're just learning about sound?
You have no stories to tell yet.
Exactly.
And you have only heard a tiny fraction of the shit that's eventually going to shape you. But it's been fun for me going back to one of the first things that did that. And then also realizing it took that dude, at my age, longer than I've been playing, you know what I mean? To be putting out records and stuff. To actually get that sound that we all know now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I just think it's interesting. But I don't know. I started playing that kind of music when I was pretty young, and then always coming to Denver because there wasn't really a music scene.
So
in
you just rolling. Yeah, Cheyenne's not that far too. What, 2 hours?
Exactly.
3 hours?
Tops. No, it's 1.5 to 2, depending on
the
traffic.
You're technically a local Denver boy.
We get grandfathered in. If you had to grow up in Cheyenne, we get grandfathered in.
Oh, that's fucked up.
You know what I'm saying?
They're come on. Yeah. Give Wyoming their own personality.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Do you rep Wyoming or do you rep Colorado?
On the road, I feel like I rep Denver since we're all from where we all live here. You know, the band is based here and stuff. And this is where I feel like I grew up musically a little bit more, because I've been playing with Denver musicians since before I lived here, of course, growing up in Cheyenne.
How old were you?
Well, I started playing gigs when I was 14, but...
Holy
by the
shit.
Time I was 16 or so, I was able to play with cats from here, a little bit
like
more.
Who?
The guys in my band are John Wertz, John on the organ. I didn't meet him till I was 18 or 19, but man, I joined Otis Taylor's band when I was 19, and he's a Boulder guy. People don't know that.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Well, so you were torn by 19?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't go to college, when I got out. Because I was gigging in high school, so it was it didn't really seem to make a lot of sense.
What did Otis teach you about music?
His thing, I didn't really know about his thing that much when I first went out. He had me come audition in Boulder, and I thought I was auditioning for a Chicago blues gig. Well, if you know Otis's thing, it's trancey and way more psychedelic and lots of world music, African type of sounds and stuff. So I thought I fucking failed that audition terribly. I was what was that shit?
Yeah.
But he ended up calling me and taking me on tour. And then I kind of learned how to play to that trance thing a little bit.
Yeah.
Because he's a 1 or 2 chord guy. Kind of the North Mississippi stuff, the hill country stuff.
1 to 2 chord, not like a 12-bar traditional?
I don't mean literally 2 chord, but I mean he'll R.L. Burnside kind of style where he'll jam on just 1 or 2 chords.
Oh, word.
Trance-wise, and you change when he changes.
That's
you
know crazy. What I mean? Is that harder to be a backup band for a dude who's you got to really listen to what he's playing?
Yeah, and there wasn't, I didn't have a lot of records to reference because he's such an original kind of cat. He takes that sound and then gets really psychedelic and weird, and you never know what he's going to do. And he's really dark. And a lot of blues today, contemporary blues, kind of goes the other way. It's a little more
happy.
Crowd pleasing. Yeah, exactly. Well, not but it's his thing is so intense and dark. You have to like learn how to do that. And I wasn't used to that. And I feel like I took a lot from that, even with my group, like really loved the trance thing, you know? And
You do a lot of transy kind of like, take your time, space style stuff.
Yeah. And keeping the groove super heavy. I love that about his thing. So man, and he like took me to Europe many, many times between ages of like 19.
Were you single?
You know, enough.
So were you getting some pussy enough. And shit?
Yeah. It was a good time.
Yeah, let's go, Taylor. So they're all the old heads. And then you're the young head.
Exactly. Like they would call me at the airport. They would call me Z-Boy. Is Z-Boy with you? You know, I'm like, damn it. I'm 19. You know,
it's like,
I'm legal.
Fuck all y'all.
But it was funny coming from Wyoming and then being out there like in Paris, like five times a year. You know, that was like my education rather than like going to school and shit. So
yeah,
I don't know. That's how I ended up moving to Denver and playing with more Denver musicians and stuff like that.
Go back to your first Europe tour, because I love traveling Europe, and I know fucking Europe loves fucking blues bands, but it's like all old people and shit.
Yeah.
So like, it's so
I'd be
funny.
Looking. I would definitely be looking, like peeking out before you start to see is there any like young, maybe even young women in this crowd. Sometimes there would be, but it's like those theaters. You know those theaters where people have like a subscription.
Yeah,
there's a lot of those types of gigs. So that's like definitely like gray hairs, you know. But they fucking loved it, and you know, because you go over there, they like to party, but they're like more listeners too, especially with the Roots stuff.
Yeah.
And Otis's thing again is so intense, and he has such like a mysterious presence that they would be locked, man. And that was some of the best audiences I had played for ever up to like that point, you know.
You ever get in trouble out there?
No.
No?
What about you? Tell me something.
I almost burned down my hotel room in Paris.
Oh, I was too young and scared to be doing shit like that.
By accident.
Really?
Yeah, it was totally by accident. It was my first time touring there. And the promoter's like, oh, just stay in Paris for the night. We'll pick you up in the morning. I'm like, I never had a hotel. I was 21, 22. Never had a hotel before. I've never been flown out to anywhere before like that. And so I took a shower, you know, fucking watched a little porn, whatever. took another shower. And then I put my fucking towel on the lamp.
Oh,
and
no.
It burned, and I went out to go drink in Paris, and it burned the fucking thing, and my flames was going up the walls and shit, but I was lucky that it was all concrete, or the whole fucking hotel would have burned down.
So when you came back, you found it, or
when
they
came back
it while you were out?
No, I came back, and I opened the door, and the promoter finally got in, like 2 a.m., I was fucking buzzed, I was stoked. Yeah. He's like, oh, can I take a piss in your hotel room? I opened it up. White smoke. So I knew it was
piss there.
Ed. Yeah. No, but like I got scared. Like I'm going to jail. Like, I fucking detective, because they don't have like fire alarms. It's like 1800.
Right,
hotels.
And the rooms are this big. So it makes sense why you had to
put
it.
So I fucking dextered the shit out of it, dude. I cleaned up everything. I cleaned up every ash I threw away. And I just like took all the evidence and threw it away in a trash can like three blocks down. And I was like so nervous. And I woke up and I'm like, hey, I don't know what happened, but it smells like
electrical fire or something. Yeah.
They gave me free breakfast.
No shit.
Let's fucking go.
Like, sorry, like,
that was my hall pass.
Miss you a fresco.
That was my hall pass. I knew that was like my one hall pass. If I kept doing that shit, I would got in trouble. I'm like, that was the universe giving me a nice little, okay. You're good.
Yeah, dude, that's sick.
About touring now? How you doing?
It's been good, man. Like, obviously, last year was fucking weird and super depressing, but we all know, though, that this summer, like, coming back, that made that shit so joyful and exuberant.
Right.
And I felt so good about that. Like, I saw you at Floyd Fest.
That was sick.
Yeah,
did you win the Rising Star thing, or?
We didn't win. To be honest, like, once I got there, I didn't pay much attention to that.
Hell yeah.
I'm like, and I'm not trying to be a dick about it, but just, like, to me, like there to play music and do the thing and however, like, cause they like had us on this stage where like, I guess you could vote on the app for your favorite band. Cause it's like the bands that nobody's heard of.
Yeah.
So, but I'm like, I'm just trying to play and kick some ass. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I can. So
you did kick ass.
Thanks.
That
man.
Was when I was really like, I've heard your name and we played a little bit, but that was the first time I got to watch like 2 year sets.
Thanks, man. Cause you were at the one where it got kind of rained out outside.
And you played inside a tent.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
And then they moved you to like the cafeteria.
Yeah.
And that was sick.
Yeah. I wish I saw you. I would have pulled you up on stage. Dude. I didn't see you. We were in like a zone. Cause that was crazy. Cause like when you're somebody like us, it's like, you know how it is when you're trying to be up and coming or whatever. And you're like, every set counts, you know, all that shit. And so like, And man, you spend so much money on the road sometimes just to be out there and do it. And people don't realize that, but like,
yeah, you're like, you know, I want to talk about that because, you know, you're the reason, you're like the perfect candidate for a company like Repsy. So keep talking about this.
Well, and then a moment comes like that, like we got to Floyd Fest and we're from here and we've been wanting to play Floyd Fest for years. So we finally got it. We're out there getting ready and then it starts raining so bad and you're like, shit, dude, we drove all this way, you know, and you're thinking of all that stuff.
And you felt like that's a real anchor gate.
Exactly. Thing, you know, like, oh, especially for us, because we don't have we're not doing that as much, you know, we're working it to get there. But like, so anyway, when the whole festival got rained out for an hour, but everybody ended up in our tent because we were the one.
Lucky.
The one, yeah. And so like.
It was meant to be.
It was, man. And that was like one of my favorite sets of the whole fucking summer, just because like that energy was there. And I felt like you said, with the thing with the fire in Paris, you're like, all right, something's on my side a little bit, at least today, you know? And then I ended up getting to sit in with you and Leftover Sam and Keller Williams, all kind of because of that.
Yeah.
And it's fucking crazy how shit happens. Dude. And then people wonder why
I mean, you're an amazing guitar player.
Oh, thank
you. You really are.
I'm trying.
Dude, you're doing great. You remind me, you look, I don't know if it's just because you look like him, but you remind me of Trucks.
Oh, I love him and all the Almond stuff, you know.
When did you start getting into all that stuff?
I was into the Almonds like mildly when I was a teenager, but I got so into old school blues at that time that the blues rock stuff, like, I kind of like, you push it away because I feel like if I'm going to be really legit, I'm going to listen to only the oldest, coolest, old school, you know, deepest shit, which is cool to go there. But anyway, like, I got more into the Almonds when I was probably 18. I saw Derek Trucks play when I was 17.
Have you heard of him before?
I had heard of him, but I was like, you got to remember, I'm living in Cheyenne.
Yeah.
So it's not like these people are coming to town. The fucking Allman Brothers aren't coming to town. You know what I'm saying? It's totally. It's like maybe Garth Brooks one time during the summer, which I'm not going to, you know, and then whatever cover bands are like happening at the bars at the time, you know? So anyway, like we got on a festival, that festival in Fort Collins, Bohemian Nights, New West Fest, you know?
Yeah.
And they were headlining it.
That's a great fest.
It is, man. We played it a bunch growing up and like they were headlining it and it was just when Tedeschi Trucks Band like became a thing. And anyway, I don't know, man. They just like blew me away. I had never heard improvising on that level, I guess. Because that's the thing I was thinking about today that I was like, probably one of the reasons I fell in love with blues so much early on is because they're like improvising. Like there's structure to the tune, but what they're playing is just what they feel. And then like seeing a band that is such strong improvisers as that band, like blew me away at the time. You know what I mean? So that kind of like, you know, when something happens, it kind of changes your trajectory just by one notch.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those. So then I got really into the Allman Brothers thing and like the jam thing. And I ended up getting to be on a record with Warren Haynes because of Otis on an Otis record.
What? Did you get to talk to Warren?
Not really, you know, no. But it was still fucking cool.
Fucking
I was
amazing.
Like 20 and I was like, I didn't think I would ever get to do anything like that. I was planning on like living in a van or whatever if I had to. And still haven't had to, but you know, whatever.
Let's go. I'll clap to that. That's a win. You know? That's a win. Let's go.
But then I'm getting to play with Warren, and it was like that blew my mind. So I've just been into that stuff since then. But yeah, I'm totally a Trucks fan and like a Dwayne fan, of course, and Dickie.
Then I felt like you guys have the really close tone, same tone. Is that part? I'm dumb with how guitar tone gets made and style.
You.
Like, is it a style thing or is it like you have the same amps? Like, what
I think
do you got?
Part of it is like, I don't like to use a lot of pedal type of gear too much. I'm not like a snob about it, but I just, it's just, even when I do plug them in, I forget that they're there a lot of the time. You know what I mean? So like that thing. And then I like this really full range type of sound. So there's like, if you want to get like kind of nerdy about it, it's like the like Stevie Ray Vaughan type of sounds with the Ibanez tube screamer. You know, it's like the overdrive pedal that's way more compressed and a little more like nasally type of sound.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of it is like full range overdrive, which doesn't like compress the amp so much. And it more sticks to like the amp's kind of tube tone. That's the kind of drive I like. So I think maybe, and because of players like him and Jimmy Herring and Dwayne Allman and Dickie Betts, like that kind of cleanish overdrive, like it's more clear. It's not super fuzzy and whatever. So I like that sound, which is probably still coming from like the BB King thing and Freddie King. And so it's just because I'm so into like the blues thing.
Isn't it amazing how many people those guys inspired?
Yeah, it's fucking nuts. Like the whole sound.
Yeah.
Even just like that tracing back just right there. It's like, well, obviously they're playing like that because it's coming from the original cats, you know?
Totally.
So I think just like that awareness. And I think we probably, I don't know Derek Trucks, but I think we probably listen to a lot of the same shit just because it's like I love gospel, old school gospel music and all the Southern stuff, you know, like I was listening to Mississippi Fred McDowell last night with a bunch of gospel singers from Como, Mississippi. It's like I like that deep,
what
greasy, swampy shit. Well, it's like swampy and like grease type of stuff, like playing on the backside of the beat, you know, like that's something I'm really into. And I try to have be kind of a staple of our sound a little bit with
you write songs like that.
Yeah. And try to keep it like, and even just the way that I approach like funk music and stuff is like a little more on the greasy side than on the up front end of it side. And I'm trying to work on that and get better just like with vocabulary to be able to go on both ends of the spectrum more. Yeah. But like that greasy stuff, you know what I'm saying? Like that's what I'm really into. And so I think that's like a thread in a lot of those groups. You
so
know?
You got your sound. You're fucking in your prime, baby. I like it. You're just keep you're just you never plateau and you keep moving step by step.
Trying.
How hard is it to be in a band of your caliber right now after COVID?
It's a bitch for a lot of reasons. One of which is like you know how the grind is, and you know how like there are different parts of the grind where like you'll kind of shoot up a little bit more. Yeah. You'll be like working really hard, just barely moving, and then you'll kind of just catch a wave. We were like at an early stage of kind of catching one of those waves because we had just signed with a really good booking agency, Madison House. And before then, we had never had an agency. Mm-hmm. So anytime that I was out on the road, like we were pounding the keys, sending emails, trying to make that shit happen. You know how it is.
You were doing it? You're hustling it?
Oh, yeah.
Good for you.
And I would have like maybe one other person helping, you know. And then finally, like got good management, got a booking agency. So they start booking the summer. And that's when we felt like, all right, we've got this thing that we do and we know it's like got some power to it. We just need to get out there and do it consistently. Because, you know, when you're trying to do it yourself, it's like it takes forever to get one tour booked. So it felt like we were kind of hitting one of those points. Then COVID happened and all the shit that we had worked for just got put on pause or whatever.
That's got to be the hardest when you're new and like you're just getting in the ears and eyes of people.
Yeah, that was what was weird. Like a lot of people talked about it being a break and like kind of nice. And I get that. But like for me, it was like, oh, shit, we were just kind of getting there to where I felt like we might, you know, pick up some steam. So that was super frustrating, but I feel like we picked it up this summer.
I feel like the bands at your level, because the bands are like our level and bigger. Like I'm not even in a big band, but like was in enough level where, you know, I could take a chill pill. For you guys, when you're on your grind and you're just starting your grind, you're like, fuck this. I don't want to fucking stop.
I know. Cause you know how it is. You're trying to get people to remember your name. Cause you're like you're trying to do something so powerful to them that they fucking remember your name. You know what I'm saying? So right when you're starting to get there and then it gets pulled away, it felt like the rug got pulled out from under us. But man, I'm like grateful for this year. And dude, I want to talk about your shit because I've been thinking about this ever since we started, or when we hung out at Floyd Fest, I guess. Mm-hmm. But when I first played with you, I don't know if you remember this, but we played at Globe Hall.
Oh, fuck.
And it wasn't that long ago. It was like maybe like 5 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah. That was the first time we were really starting to get somewhere in Denver.
Yeah. And that was crazy. It's crazy to me because like that was not that long ago. It was Globe Hall. It was great. It was the shit. It was the first time I had met you. But like there was like 100 people in Globe Hall, which was awesome to me. That was like, this is it. This is success. If I could do this in every city in this country, I'm in. Mm-hmm. So, then like the next time I saw you, I didn't play with you, but I just happened to be there. You were at the other side. It serves.
Yeah.
And it was fucking packed. And that's when I was like, oh, this dude just is catching one of those waves. Because I knew you had been working for years and years and years.
Yeah.
But I saw like the wave, right? Yeah. You know what I mean? When you catch one. And then the next time I saw you was at Floyd Fest. And now all this stuff is going so well for you and I'm so excited about it. But you inspire me because I know that you worked so long, like moving like, you know.
Yeah.
Not static, but you know, it's
just a couple steps at a time.
Yeah, baby steps, but it takes forever, you know? And then I've just like seen you, even though I don't know you that well, I've seen you the past few years do the thing.
Yeah.
But after working so hard for so long that there had to be times that you thought about giving up.
Dude, I still think about giving up.
Exactly. And it's like, it inspires me, man, because I always get heady about like not being where you want to be at your certain age or whatever. Like, fuck, people are passing me by. And then I remember like, no, man, the real cats work real hard for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then things click along the way. And you know, so you're inspiring me like that for real, man.
Thanks,
I mean,
Taylor, that means a lot, bro.
Keeps me positive.
You know what it is too? You know, it's just like not looking at other people's success and be on your own fucking path.
Not comparing yourself.
Cause that's what's going to kill you. You know, that's what's going to make your fucking dreams devalue.
Yeah.
So like you just got to appreciate small victories and just keep moving forward a fucking soldier, dude.
Because it'll fuck you musically, too.
It will.
Comparing yourself. And it's like, dude, you don't sound like that guy. Why are you trying to, you know what I mean? Like, you're not supposed to sound like that guy.
That's the problem with the music industry is that one band catches a wave and everyone wants to start doing that. And the
chase
minute
the trend.
And then the minute they put out the record, they're already at a different trend.
Yep.
So you got to be individual. You got to fucking put your dick out there every goddamn day, Taylor.
Dig.
And get it. What do you love about the progression of your career, if you could say anything?
Man, like, I know this might sound a little cliche, but, like, I'm a people person. Mm-hmm. And I fucking love... I didn't realize that this was going to be my favorite thing about music, aside from the actual playing of music on stage. But, like... The way that your community grows, you know, like your personal community. I have, and you're like this even more so than me because you're further down the road. But like, you have communities that feel like family in all these different geographical locations all over the country or even world. And I am so into that connection. Like I'm the kind of person that like I'll spend time talking on the phone all day if I have it, just to friends to catch up. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because I like to hang. I don't go skiing. I don't have shit like that. Other than music, I hang the fuck out with people. Yeah, like exactly same. Like we're doing right now. That's what I like to do. I like to drink and smoke and chill and hang out with people because I'm passionate about people. So it's like with music, people love musicians, especially if you're actually a cool person. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you get like this network of people throughout the country. I don't know, man. I just feel so close to so many people. Both people I play with music with and people that are just, you know, a part of the scene some way. People let you stay at their fucking house. You know what I mean? All that kind of stuff of being on the road has become like my favorite thing. It's just that connection. And it can be super personal or it can just be with like the audience. But either way, man, like I didn't realize that that's probably why I'm in it, aside from just the fact that I like playing the guitar and stuff.
I always think of that too. It's like, okay, great. You love music. You're passionate about music, but you got to love the hang.
You
more.
Have to. Yeah, especially being on the road because the show
is 2 hours.
If you
want to be a touring band. Yeah. What are you else going to do for 14 hours?
Yeah, exactly. And you know how the drives are. I saw you posted something that cracked me up. Like, you know, nothing like a day off that's actually an 11-hour drive, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like that shit. You've got to have your head and kind of heart in that hang, I feel like. And that's like when the bands get the strongest, I feel like, too, and at least in my experience.
Yeah, bonding.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to love it. You can't be like, God damn, this fucking drive, and then we have to sit around, sound check. Like, we have days we feel like that. But in general, if that's your attitude, you're fucked, man. Like, you should keep it local. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Because then the whole rest of the day is hard. To me, the show is like... the fun, easy part.
Yeah, that's the present moment. You know, that's what we get us high to keep us going. But like that other stuff is what we have to accept is going to be our life.
Yeah, and you got to keep a sense of humor about it. Obviously, you guys are great with that, you and Nick and everybody. But like, man, that thing of like laughing down the road with people is my favorite thing in the world.
Dude, it makes everything so much better. Like, enjoy the company you're with. Don't like fight. Like, if you don't like someone, fucking, I mean, some bands is hard. You're like, if you don't like them, fucking kick them out. I get it.
Right.
You can't kick them out. But, like, try to have fun with each other.
I know, man. And, like, it's not that hard, I feel like, if you're halfway self-aware, you know. But, like...
mostly when people aren't fucking not getting along is because they don't like the touring.
Uh-huh.
You know?
I don't want to sleep on another couch or share a room again or all that.
It's got to be harder with old cats in your band.
Yeah.
You got to give them hotels and spoil them, dog.
It's different. It is definitely different than just jumping in the van with friends. Now they're my close friends, but when I first met them, it was like, yo, I'm hiring you for a gig.
Yeah.
And we go on the road because, like, John Wertz is one of my best friends. He's been in my band since I was 19.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, like, basically everywhere I've been, other than the Otis thing, John has been there too. So, like, and that dude, he's older than me by maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. But, like, he always treated me with respect and shit. You know what I mean? On the road. And he was always cool about it. But sometimes, it's pressure to try to make sure everybody's comfortable on the road.
Mm-hmm.
That shit gets out. We used to go to this place. And have you ever been to Edmonton?
Edmonton.
Alberta?
No. Canada?
Yeah.
You guys playing Canada?
Oh, yeah, man.
You popping out there?
Let's go.
You popping to Canada. Let's go, Tay.
Oh, man. There was this club that... I don't think they do this anymore. I think they got a new ownership or something. But from the time I was 19 till about 2 years ago, this club up there called Blues on White, that you could do 7-night residencies.
Oh,
touring bands,
sick.
They would let you come play for 7 nights. So the first 5 nights, there's nobody there. You're just practicing, basically, you know. But it's still a wild place.
And they'll hook you up for dinner every night.
Oh, yeah, they'll make
it
happen. And they paid pretty good. So we'd go sit up there for a week, and the weekends were fucking nuts. But the hotel was, like, next door. and it was pretty disgusting.
And the word, oh hell yeah, you were blacking out, dude.
Yeah, yeah, so you, but I was blacking out, but like
your boy is like, yeah, we're going to fucking bed. Right, you go enjoy yourself, Taylor.
Exactly, man. And like, man, we came in the first time that we were there. Like my neighbors at the hotel, the people on either side of me, one was a live-in hooker, and the other died from OD while I was there. You know, and they like pulled him out. So I'm like, guys, the hotel's a little rough. You know what I'm saying? But you know, if you get, you can change rooms if you need to. If your room smells like smoke or something, whatever, we'll make it work. Then we walk in and they're pulling a dude out on a fucking gurney.
Welcome to Canada, yeah, boys.
It's like welcome to Blues on White, baby. You know, but that kind of shit. And then you're looking at guys that, in my case, are like sometimes twice as old as me or more, and I respect them musically and whatever. And you're like, fuck. Sorry, I have to stick you in this situation.
No, they were trying to do it. They love it. They believe in
it. They were cool about it always. Yeah. That's, yeah.
That's the shit. Taylor, wow. What a story. And I can't wait. We're going to do a deeper, we're going to go deep dive into the mind of Taylor Scott in another episode. But I just want people to get to know that Taylor. Taylor's an amazing guitar player out of Colorado. His band's starting to get a buzz. And I wanted to get him on the show because, you know, he deserves it. You deserve fucking all the success in the world because you work hard, you're a genuine dude, and you're fucking likable, dude. Thanks, you're not a dick. I appreciate that.
Try not to be a dick.
All right, so I got one last thing. Oh, first, before we do that, where can people find your music? Where can people find your Instagram?
It's modestly titled the Taylor Scott Band.
Hell yeah.
And Instagram, Taylor Scott Band, and Spotify or wherever you listen to stuff. We got new music out that we're putting out every 6 weeks or so right now.
Let's go.
Yeah.
All right, Taylor. I want you to pump up our crowd for the week. I want you to, if people are having a hard time, I want you to give them some optimism for the week. Are you ready?
I think I'm ready.
Let's fucking go.
All right. What I try to do is keep it smoking, drinking, and chilling. You know what I'm saying?
Hell yeah.
Keep it light. When I'm feeling a little bad, right now we're back home. A lot of us, we're off the road. You know, things are a little less busy. So you got to find a way to like keep it smoking, drinking, and chilling at home. So for me, I'm trying to spend time safely, of course, when you can, with people that I really love that I haven't got to see throughout the craziness of the summer. So if you're feeling a little fucked up right now, or a little maybe you got that seasonal thing, we know the time just changed. That shit fucks with me a little bit,
me
man.
Me too, bro.
You know what? I'm trying to go to bed earlier, get up a little earlier, make sure I'm spending time with my friends, keep it wholesome, cook a meal. That's what I'm talking about. We're coming off the road. Cook a meal, man. Cook a meal with a friend. It'll make you feel better.
Well, amen. Thanks for being on the show, buddy. Bela Fleck and Taylor Scott. What a fucking episode.
Cheers,
let's
man.
Get it, bro.
Appreciate
thanks for
you.
Coming, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon. We'll talk to you in 7 days.
You tuned in to the World's Heavy Podcast with Andy Fresco, now in its fourth season. Thank you for listening to this episode, produced by Andy Fresco, Joe Angelo, and Chris Lawrence. We need you to help us save the world and spread the word. Please subscribe, rate the show, give us those crazy stars, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you're picking this shit up. Follow us on Instagram at World Saving Podcast for more info and updates. Fresco's blogs and tour dates you find at andyfresco.com. And check our socials to see what's up next. Might be a video dance party, a showcase concert, that crazy shit show, or whatever springs to Andy's wicked brain. And after a year of keeping clean and playing safe, the band is back on tour. We thank our brand new talent booker, Mara Davis. We thank this week's guest, our co-host, and all the fringy frenzies that help make this show great. Thank you all. And thank you for listening. Be your best, be safe, and we will be back next week.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast as far as we know. Any similarity to actual knowledge, facts, or fake is purely coincidental.